When you consider that 70% of the Earth's surface is water, you'll realize that you're only getting a small glimpse of our planet's wonders when you just stick to exploring what's on land. Getting below the surface usually involves scuba diving to experience the underwater world. It's not really as difficult or out of reach to do that as you might imagine. Diving experts Kerry Miller and Chris Taylor believe that we care about what we experience firsthand. So they've written the National Geographic book, A Diver's Guide to the World, Remarkable Dive Travel Destinations Above and Beneath the Surface. Their mission is to get divers traveling and to get travelers diving, to help everyone experience the connections between our planet's green and blue spaces. They're with us right now on Travel with Rick Steves from their home in Byron Bay, Australia. Kerry, Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting us to be here.
Thanks.
You know, this concept is just great. I've never thought of it. It's just kind of cool. Your mission, to have divers more enthusiastic about traveling and travelers a little more clued into diving. And that's really what your book, A Diver's Guide to the World, is all about. It doesn't just talk about great places to dive. It talks about great places to go, to travel to, and to dive. Is that right, Kerry?
Yeah, that's right. This book actually started out very organically. When Chris and I first met, he was an experienced diver, and I was a complete water baby. I loved snorkeling, but I hadn't started diving yet. And so we'd travel together, and Chris would spend half the day underwater, and I'd spend half the day on land having some sort of adventures. And we'd get together for lunch or dinner and talk about what we had seen and done. And the other one was just green with envy, and we realized just how much we were missing out on. And so that's where this concept came from, is that this is the best way to see a place both above and below.
And a great example of that, I just had so much fun reading through the book. There's a little tiny island I had never heard of in the Caribbean, Saba, and it's got like 2,000 people. It's a Dutch colony or something like that. And I was looking at it thinking in terms of, okay, diving, what are we going to see if we dive here? And I kept thinking, I want to travel here also. And Kerry, tell us a little bit about Saba, how it's kind of great above the water and below the water.
Well, it's funny because it's the highest point in the Netherlands. So there's actually a cloud forest on it. It's just this kind of triangular drop of an island, just emerald green. It has a wandering beach that shows up from time to time. So travelers who go there, it's amazing for hiking. It's got incredible hiking. And then they set up a marine park way before they needed one. And so the underwater world is really rich.
Nice. Yeah, it just looked adorable as far as a little island to visit, and the diving looked great too. Chris, what about you? If you had you're talking to a couple and one of them wanted to travel and the other wanted to dive, where would you recommend they go where they both could be happy?
One really good place that comes to mind is Bormes Le Mimosa. I've probably just absolutely wrecked the name. In the south of France, it's very close to Saint-Tropez and Nice. It's got all that glitz and glamour that you'd expect from the south of France, and wineries and beautiful scenery and all of that. But there's also absolutely brilliant diving there. And most people tend to think of the Mediterranean as this dead place that's not worth diving anymore because it's just so overfished. But Bormes actually created a marine park in the 60s. So it's been there for a very long time. And so the diving there is actually very, very good. There's a lot of wildlife still. And there's also some great wreck diving. So it would definitely suit both divers and non-divers alike.
And that's in the south of France on the Riviera near Saint-Tropez?
Yeah, it's not far from Saint-Tropez. I think it's about 25, 30 minutes to Saint-Tropez, if I remember correctly.
Because, you know, one point on my notes a little further down here is, are some places dead compared to others, like the Mediterranean Sea? And you answered it there. I guess the Mediterranean Sea in general could be not as colorful and full of life as another place, but certain areas that have taken care of their environment? Or how does that work, Kerry?
Well, the Mediterranean is an interesting one. Oceans, just like places, are shaped by history and culture. And the Mediterranean has been this thoroughfare for trade and culture for such a long time. But currently, less than 2% of it is actively protected. And the rest is just in this kind of high seas, wild west territory with no country having jurisdiction. So when you're diving, you see that there's a sense of it being overfished and being overused to some degree. But there are these pockets that are being protected. And when you see the difference between protected ocean and not protected ocean, you see what it could be or what it was like.
That's fascinating that that would be that effective, that you could have a vast sea that's not adequately protected, but if there is a small little zone that is taken care of, that would actually be full of life.
Correct. And it spills over. So that zone, the fish, you know, obviously don't know the boundaries. So then they spill out into non-protected areas, and that helps everybody. That helps the divers, that helps fishermen, that helps everybody.
So I guess that would relate to if you're flying across the Caribbean, you look down at the island of Hispaniola, and you got the Dominican Republic, and you got Haiti. And from the air, you can see a straight line, which is the border. One side has trees, and the other side is desolate. It's because of human treatment. And the same would be, you could say, underwater.
This is the really important thing about dive travel, is that we need more people to see the sea. We need more eyes on the ocean. It's become kind of this global blue carpet to just sweep things under. The more people that see it, that can see what's happening underwater, the more we engage with it and encourage to protect it.
Especially there have been projects taking leaders of different countries out scuba diving, especially in the Pacific, where some of the leaders had never scuba dived and seen their own reefs. And that has led to the establishment of marine parks.
And like we said in the very beginning, you know, we care most about what we've experienced firsthand. So I suppose you could almost have an environmentalist agenda behind your book, A Diver's Guide to the World, if more people can not just travel there, but take a look at what's, like Kerry said, under the rug. You might be a little more interested in making sure everything is well taken care of. Dive experts Chris Taylor and Kerry Miller recommend 50 deep-sea diving locations in 35 countries in their book, A Diver's Guide to the World. It's published by National Geographic. Kerry's also written 100 Dives of a Lifetime, the world's ultimate underwater destinations. Their website is beneaththesurface.media, which is also the name of their Instagram account. You know, when I looked at your map, most of your favorite destinations are in the tropical or subtropical areas, but I did notice that you had Valdez in Alaska and Orkney at the very top of Scotland. My impression would be that tropical is better than Arctic for scuba diving, not just because the water's warmer, but there's more to see. How would you answer that?
Look, I wouldn't say one is better than the other, but when it comes to where people like to go and travel and go on holiday, I'd probably say the majority of people would prefer to go on holiday to a warm destination. But cold water environments around the world are absolutely spectacular underwater. Sometimes they're even more colorful than corresponding tropical reefs. It's amazing.
So tell us, Chris, what we might see at Valdez, Alaska, or in Orkney, north of Scotland.
So in Valdez, if you go diving, there's very, very pretty sponge corals and anemones underwater there. I also did something that was very, very unique. I was able to go for a scuba dive in a river with spawning salmon. And that was pretty spectacular. We were only 2 or 3 feet underwater lying in the river. But then the salmon, just thousands and thousands of salmon, just swim straight past you in the river. And in the meantime, Kerry had to sit up top on a log with one of the other guides with a shotgun and bear spray.
I was going to say, you could be very zen underwater watching the salmon, and all of a sudden, bam, in a bear claw snaps one of them out, and you'd be seeing it from underwater.
Exactly. In the Orkneys, as a contrast, there's a lot of wildlife in northern Scotland, but that wasn't the main reason we went to the Orkneys. For diving in the Orkneys, we particularly went there for wreck diving, to see the sunken shipwrecks that are there. So oh, yeah. Orkney is a massive natural harbor.
Oh, Orkney is famous for its shipwreck. It's World War I and World War II shipwrecks.
Exactly. So mainly World War I, but yeah. Orkney's been a harbor since the Viking times. It's been this incredible place, a melting pot of cultures for centuries. But yes, in the First World War, the British captured the German fleet at the end of the First World War, collected all the ships, pretty much all of the ships in the Orkney Islands, and the German commanders who were still on the ships decided to sink the ships so they wouldn't fall into British hands. So they all scuttled all of their ships in this big harbour, and a lot of them are still there and still diveable as wrecks, which is pretty spectacular.
And to this day, it's contributing to the economy by attracting divers to that humble community north of Scotland. Kerry, when I was reading through your book, I realized you both live in Byron Bay in Australia, and that's one of the locations in the book. Is that a particularly special place for diving? Is that why you ended up living there?
It is. Byron Bay is a very, very special place for a couple of reasons. First of all, the diving is one of the best dive spots on the planet, but not even Australians know how good it is. It's this little hunk of rock just offshore called Julian Rocks, and it's right smack in the East Australian Current. So everything that's migrating up and down the east coast of Australia stops in for a visit. So it changes. All the seasons change. You get leopard sharks and manta rays at one time a year. You get gray nurse sharks at another time, humpbacks stopping in. So it's just incredible, ever-changing, diverse diving.
Well, it's the easternmost tip of Australia, right? So it would make sense that all of the parade of fish would go around that tip.
Yes, they do. And they stop in for a rest or to have a feed when they're migrating. It's also the place that Chris and I both learned to dive, ironically, and not together either.
Huh. Now, you know, I was intrigued and sort of inspired by your book because I've never scuba dived, but I love to snorkel, and I know the thrill of snorkeling. Can you explain, Chris, to our listeners, how is the diving experience different than snorkeling? Is snorkeling essentially good enough, or what does diving free you up to experience?
So snorkeling is wonderful, and it's a great experience, and it's obviously easily accessible for a lot of people. What diving does is when you're snorkeling, you're looking down on everything, so you're getting this one perspective from above, 10, 15 feet above what's going on. Diving is a lot more immersive because you are on the same level as the fish. And in a lot of cases, the fish aren't scared of you. So unlike if you're walking through a forest and you see a deer, the deer will get skittish and it'll run away. Unlike that, underwater, a lot of the animals do not perceive us as a threat at all. So I find that the wildlife interactions underwater are a lot closer. So you get much more intertwined into the goings on.
So you mean a snorkeler is perceived more of a threat because they're coming at him from the top, whereas a diver is part of the scene?
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that the snorkeler is perceived as more of a threat, but just in general, we're often not perceived as a threat by animals in the ocean, which is great.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're exploring beneath the surface right now with dive experts Carrie Miller and Chris Taylor. They're the team behind National Geographic's Diver's Guide to the World, remarkable dive travel destinations above and beneath the surface. You can find out more about Chris and Carrie and their work at Beneath the Surface Media on Instagram. So, Carrie, let's say I'm ready to go on my first dive and I've learned what I need to learn and so on. Can you explain to me the actual process? You're going to take me diving. What's the process? What are we going to do? How do I suit up? What do I need to be mindful of?
So first thing is that you'll check into the dive shop that's going to be taking us out. Most of the diving is done with a guide. You can self-guide and you can self-dive, but for most purposes, you go through a dive shop. So we'll start there. And if you have your own gear, you start putting that together. If you don't have any gear, they'll kit you out with gear. So they'll get you your wetsuit. They'll get you your tank and your regulator that you're going to breathe through. And they'll give you a dive briefing, a very comprehensive briefing on what we're going to see, what the conditions are like. And then some basic, if things go wrong, this is what we're going to do. If somebody gets lost or if the weather conditions change, this is how we're going to behave. So that's a very comprehensive briefing. And then you go out in a boat, usually out to the dive location. Everybody checks their gear, make sure everybody's comfortable and ready to go, and then you just dive in.
Do you travel with your gear or do you rent it as you go?
You can do both. Chris and I like to travel with our gear because it's familiar, and so therefore it's comfortable. Yeah. But obviously that's an entire suitcase worth of gear. And obviously a lot of people who only like to dive once or twice a year don't have their own gear. And if that's the case, then the dive shop will provide it. So then you don't actually need to bring anything.
So, Chris, it seems like it's an expensive sport. First of all, you got to be able to travel to a place and everything. And if I go, let's say, to Belize, and I want to go out onto the Keys, famous for diving, so there's people there ready to rent me gear. I've got absolutely nothing. I know how to dive. How much would it cost?
It's probably about $100 a dive is probably the global average. But obviously, depending on where you're diving, it can be cheaper or it can be more expensive.
Okay, so that's no different than skiing or something like that. And you're not paying for lifts, so that's good. Although you will probably have a guide and a boat and this kind of thing as an option.
But that will usually be included in your $100 fee because the guide won't be generally, I mean, you can get a private guide, but generally it'll be a group thing.
So you go out with a group. And getting certified, how involved is it? If let's say I'm a good swimmer, how do I get certified?
So getting certified is actually kind of like learning to drive a car. So there's the theory part where you study the theory and then you practice with a qualified instructor. And then basically you're ready to go. And from there, your proficiency depends on how often you practice, your comfort levels, and how regularly you dive.
But how many hours do you have to take programs to learn and how much does that cost?
Sure. So it's theory that you can do online. You can do the theory part by yourself. And then that would probably take a few hours to go through the theory. And then you have four dives that you do with an instructor. And so that's two usually in the pool where you go through your basic skill sessions and then two out in open water. And then they'll answer any questions that you had during the theory part. Cost-wise, it varies depending on location, but say ballpark about $350.
So you could go to some nice Caribbean beach resort and spend the time and money, and in a week you could be fully certified and safe to dive after that?
Absolutely. And the best part is you can do your theory before you get to your Caribbean island, so you can get the classroom work done before you even go. So all you're focusing on is dining. For sure. We'll do it with you.
Okay, because I was really inspired when you wrote about how diving made your world a bigger place. I just want to wrap up our discussion by share for me that first time you actually dived and the eureka that swept over you.
I just had no idea what I was missing out on. No idea. Like I said, I've been a lifelong snorkeler, but when I got down there and was looking around and there is so much life down there and there is so much variety in landscapes, it mirrors the terrestrial. I never knew that existed down there. It was such a life-changing moment.
The authors of A Diver's Guide to the World are our guests right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Chris Taylor and his wife, Kerry Miller, are joining us from their home in Byron Bay, Australia. You'll find more about our guests with each week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Paint a picture for those of us who have never been down there. I can imagine, you know, wispy currents and forests that kind of dance of greenery and spooky fish coming out of dark holes. What's your dreamy image that you would share with me if I was able to dive with you?
Well, so as you descend, you've got the rays of the sunlight piercing through the water and just illuminating it. And then you look down and you might see a coral city and it's all bright and colorful and oranges and purples and pinks. And you've got this city of life that's just happening with fish flitting in and out of the coral, going about their daily fish lives. And then you've got eagle rays swooping over these sand channels, soaring over the sand, and then you get some bigger fish coming in and potentially like a reef shark coming in, and they're zippy and fun and charismatic, and all of this is happening and they're completely just ignoring you and you're just part of it. I always try to sneak in and see how much of a part of a fish school I can belong to before they figure out I'm there and leave.
Whoa. I'm telling you, this interview is having an impact on me. Chris Taylor, Kerry Miller, thanks for writing A Diver's Guide to the World, and thanks for sharing with us the wonder of your passion.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you very much. And we'd love to take you diving one day.
Let's make that happen. Byron Bay, east tip of Australia, here I come.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. I'm the executive producer, Tim Tatton. Our associate producers are Kazmira Hall and Donna Bardsley. We get website support from Andrew Wakeling, affiliate promotions from Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Thanks to Steve Camerano for his help this week. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of when and where we're broadcast at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.